Welcome to Text Messages. These recommendations for teen readers are produced by ReadWriteThink.org, a partnership between the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. This is episode 84 of Text Messages, Being a YA Lit Advocate. I'm your host, Jennifer Bueller. If you teach young adult literature or share it with teens in some other way, you know that criticism of these books is something that comes with the territory. In newspaper columns, on blog posts, in the stands at high school baseball games, and even in English department meetings, you're bound to hear people make disparaging comments about YA lit. They'll say that YA titles are depressing and dark, or they'll take the alternate tack and call them lightweight and superficial. They'll claim that the books aren't complex, and they'll argue that teens should be spending their time reading more worthwhile literature. While these criticisms sting, it's important to understand where they're coming from. People who attack YA Lit generally want to see young people reading. They just don't know enough about books for teens to understand what YA Lit has to offer. If all you've ever seen are a handful of YA bestsellers, you're not going to have any idea of the scope or the range of this literature. We who read YA Lit and believe in its worth need to be ready to engage with those who attack and dismiss it. Instead of getting angry, we can take a positive and proactive stance. We can position ourselves as YA advocates, and we can view advocacy as a way to change the conversation about books, reading, and teenagers. In this episode, I'll talk about what it means to be a YA Lit advocate and what advocacy work can look like. I'll share strategies you can use to challenge misperceptions of YA Lit and invite others to start learning about the quality and richness of today's titles. Then I'll introduce you to a variety of new books that you can recommend to teen readers and use to further your own work in YA advocacy. So what does it mean to be a YA Lit advocate, and what can YA advocacy look like? The first thing to know is that advocacy work can take lots of different forms. Some YA advocates are out there talking about books and recommending YA Lit at every opportunity. Others go the quieter route. They wait for moments when YA Lit comes up in conversation, and they respond to critiques of YA with rebuttals that they've planned and rehearsed ahead of time. As a side note, because I tend to take the quieter approach myself, I developed a set of talking points I now use to refute common criticisms of YA Lit. You can find them in the last chapter of a book I wrote for the NCTE Principles and Practice series. It's called Teaching Reading with YA Literature, Complex Stories, Complex Lives. Along those same lines, YA advocacy might mean organizing YA Lit book clubs and giving workshops for parents and teachers. But advocacy can also be something as simple as including the title of the YA book you're currently reading in your email signature line. Being a YA Lit advocate really just means being ready and willing to testify about the value of young adult literature when you could otherwise choose to remain silent. Now I want to offer a few more detailed thoughts on the simplest approach of all to YA advocacy, which is talking about the books. In general, testimonials about quality YA titles are most effective when we speak from our own personal experience as adult readers of this literature. It's one thing to make broad claims about the value of YA Lit in the lives of teens. It's another thing to be ready with specific titles that you've read and are willing to champion. Toward that end, there are three categories of books I suggest you keep in mind if you choose to read as a YA Lit advocate. The first category is books you love. Over the years, I've learned that the books I do the best job advocating for, both on this show and in my everyday life, are ones that made a strong impression on me personally. It may be because of the richness of the setting, or the complexity of the characters, or the structure of the narrative and the overall quality of the writing. It may simply be because of the feeling the story evoked in me. If the experience of reading the book felt like living inside the story world, and if the text captured my heart as well as my mind, then I know I found a book I can get behind as a YA Lit advocate. sheer passion can take you a long way in YA advocacy work. But that approach will likely say more about me as a reader than it will about any given YA title. There are lots of YA books out there that deserve our advocacy, even if they aren't personal favorites. That's why the second type of book I hope you will advocate for is one that does something original or unusual in relation to the rest of the field. These are books that are different from others of their kind, maybe because they explore subjects few others have written about, or maybe because they approach familiar subjects in new ways. Books that take risks and push the envelope of what we understand YA Lit to be always deserve the support of YA advocates. There's a third and final category of book that we need to remember in our advocacy work, and that's the one that's going to be right for a very particular kind of reader, or the one that speaks to our current cultural moment. In the first case, I'm talking about books that only a small group of teens will want to read. We should never be put off by the limited appeal of these books. Their very existence increases the likelihood that YA Lit will be able to satisfy the diverse interests of today's teens. In the second case, I'm talking about books that give voice to issues people are discussing and debating in our current world. YA Lit can make teenagers feel seen, but it can also help teens see the world around them more clearly. The narrow specificity of some titles and the timeliness of others can both affirm teens' interests and challenge their worldview. Before I wrap up these general thoughts on YA advocacy, I want to be clear that not every YA book deserves advocates. Just like any other literary category, in YA Lit you'll find good books and bad books, great books and forgettable books. But many YA titles are good. In order to find them, you'll need to read broadly and with an open mind. I've learned from teen librarians that most every book out there is going to have value for someone. Being a YA Lit advocate means defending teens' right to set their own reading purposes and make their own reading choices. As YA Lit advocates, we can ask ourselves, what does this book do for me? But we must also ask, what might this book do for others who are not like me? There's one final point about advocacy that I'd like you to bear in mind, and it may be the most important point of all. When we advocate for YA Lit, we're not just advocating for the books. We're advocating for teenagers and for the intrinsic worth of adolescence. We're showing teens that we value not only who they will someday become, but who they are right now, with all their hopes, loves, desires, fears, and flaws. Now I want to tell you about a variety of recently published YA titles that I think deserve our collective attention and advocacy. In choosing these books, I use the three categories I mentioned earlier as my guide. Some of these books are ones I personally love. Others are books that stand out as unique in the field, and still others offer those qualities of timeliness and appeal to a specific type of reader. I looked for books that were varied in terms of content, form, and purpose. You'll hear about books that take up difficult topics, raise teens' political and social consciousness, and allow teens of different kinds to see themselves. You'll also hear about books that experiment with style and blur genres. The first set of books are ones that spoke to me personally. I don't tend to read and recommend middle grade fiction, but I fell in love with Allie Benjamin's debut novel, The Thing About Jellyfish. This book about girl friendships and how they shift in painful ways at the start of middle school had me channeling my own memories of that time. When it comes to emotional honesty, I haven't read a better middle grade novel in years. It's one thing to lose your best friend when she migrates to the popular crowd and leaves you behind. It's another to learn that your best friend who left you behind has died in a freak drowning accident. This is how the story begins for main character Susie. Not only is she consumed with grief and guilt over the way things fell apart between her and Franny, she's also stunned and bewildered. How could a swimmer as strong as Franny drown during a vacation on the Maryland shore? After a school trip to an aquarium, Susie's scientific mind lands on a hypothesis. Franny died because she was stung by a poisonous jellyfish. What's beautiful about this book is how it weaves together scientific facts with an aching first-person perspective on loss. Flashbacks of a friendship as it unravels are woven together with sketches and lists from Susie's notebook. Ideas from science serve as metaphors for Susie's pain. With an acknowledgments page that explains how Benjamin built a story out of her own fascination with jellyfish, and with an author's note that guides readers to the rich array of photos, videos, and books that inform the novel, The Thing About Jellyfish is a book that kept speaking to me long after I finished it. Unfortunately, there's no shortage of rape stories in YA Lit or in our larger culture. The Way I Used to Be by Amber Smith is one of the newest YA novels to deal with the consequences of rape in the life of the victim. It also happens to be one of the most memorable and powerful rape stories I've ever read. What happens when you're just 14 years old and it's Christmas vacation of your freshman year and your beloved older brother's best friend rapes you in your bed while your parents are sleeping down the hall? What happens when he threatens to kill you if you tell? What happens when your mom notices your bloody nightgown the next morning and instead of asking questions, lectures you on the need to use a calendar to keep track of your period? For main character Eden, the answer is you go numb. Somewhere in you, rage starts to burn, but rage is eclipsed by alienation and loss. You're no longer the person you once were, and so you stop caring. When sophomore year rolls around and you change your appearance, and boys notice, and you begin to go out with them, and you develop a reputation as a slut, it's as if it's all preordained. The goodness in you was lost a long time ago. The Way I Used to Be is different from other rape novels in that it follows Eden through all 4 years of high school. For me as a reader, watching her spin out of control, lying, getting wasted, having sex at parties, and laughing as she destroys herself and other people was like rubbernecking at a car crash. You know you should look away because the wreckage is so horrifying, but you look anyway. I loved Eden, and I ached for her bad choices. When she was finally ready to heal, I felt visceral relief. You will too, and you'll never think the same way again about girls with bad reputations. Each one of them has a story, and chances are it's a painful one. Anytime a 600-page YA historical novel lands on my doorstep, I'm going to give it an interested look. If that same book has been praised by esteemed YA literary critic Michael Cart as his favorite of the year, I'm going to move it to the top of my reading pile. That being said, no genre label or critic's assessment could have prepared me for the sheer ambition or the novelty and weirdness of The Death and Life of Zebulon Finch by Daniel Krauss. This is one of those crossover novels that's likely to appeal as much to adults as to teens. The story begins in 1896 when a 17-year-old Chicago gangster named Zebulon Finch is gunned down on the shore of Lake Michigan. Only somehow he doesn't die. Instead, his body rots at the bottom of the lake until eventually his neck is pierced by a fisherman's iron hook. When he's pulled to the surface, he learns that he's still alive, and yet he doesn't eat, sleep, or bleed. He wants to die, but he can't. That's why starting a second life is no gift for Zebulon Finch. He'll spend the next 50 years bouncing from one era to the next, appearing as a freak attraction in a traveling medicine show, serving as the subject of grotesque scientific experiments performed by a lunatic doctor, fighting in the trenches of World War I, and then residing in squalor in Depression-era New York. Finally, he'll land in Hollywood as the love interest of a mid-century movie star. These plot points only scratch the surface of the deeper story, which is Zebulon's quest to atone and find redemption. This is a book that's as much about self-loathing as it is about the arc of history. With a first-person voice that drips with black humor and speaks directly to the reader, The Death and Life of Zebulon Finch makes an unforgettable addition to the growing list of genre-busting YA literary epics such as The Book Thief by Marc Ezusak, The Astonishing Life of Octavia Nothing by M.T. Anderson, and This Is All by Aidan Chambers. Here's another masterful and original YA novel that pushes the limits of what YA lit can be. If you'd like to hear Krauss talk with fellow YA author and podcaster Sarah Czar about the process of writing Zebulon Finch, look for the link in the show notes for this episode. The next set of books are ones that have stayed with me because of their important subject matter. If you follow YA nonfiction, you've no doubt heard of Most Dangerous, Daniel Ellsberg and the Secret History of the Vietnam War by Steve Sheinkin. Alongside The Thing About Jellyfish, this account of a government whistleblower who leaked the Pentagon Papers was a finalist for the National Book Award. It went on to win both the YALSA Excellence in Nonfiction Award and the Boston Globe Horn Book Award. In keeping with Sheinkin's previous works of narrative nonfiction, Most Dangerous is a page-turning suspense story. I'm an adult reader with a pretty good sense of 20th century American history, but I was fascinated and amazed by all I did not know about government lies and abuse of power during the Vietnam era. As Sheinkin explained at the National Book Awards, Daniel Ellsberg was a consummate insider, a Harvard grad and one of the architects of the Vietnam War. When he turned against the war, he decided he had a moral responsibility to help end it. That's why he sent top secret government papers to the New York Times and several other major newspapers. To some, Ellsberg was a hero. To others, he was a villain. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger called him the most dangerous man in America. Top government officials, including President Richard Nixon, resolved to ruin him. Most Dangerous is a YA title that I first read as an audiobook, so I miss the photographs, the cast of characters, the source notes, and the list of works cited, but none of that diminished my reading experience. That's because Sheinkin is such an excellent storyteller. At the National Book Awards, he explained the crux of his work in this book when he said, "I love those little moments where a life can change." The entire story of Most Dangerous hinges on the moment when Ellsberg's conscience changed, which in turn changed his life and the course of history. How could we not want to advocate for a book like this? If you'd like to watch Sheinkin read an excerpt from the book at the National Book Awards, check the show notes for this episode. Another book that will help teens learn about moments that changed the course of history is Stonewall, Breaking Out in the Fight for Gay Rights by Anne Bossom. This book is short, but it's another one that's memorable for its approach to storytelling. For starters, Bossom writes the prologue in second person. In doing so, she leads you by the hand through the streets of Greenwich Village to the Stonewall Inn. "Pay attention," she says. "History walks through that door." And then she backtracks, setting the stage for the 1969 police raid and riot that launched the gay rights movement. Drawing on quotes from gay rights activists, Bossom explains what it was like to be gay during the 1950s and 60s, which helps readers understand why the Stonewall Inn was such a refuge. The story moves back and forth between in-the-moment accounts of events unfolding and a retrospective look at how one night's riot launched an entire movement for dignity and human rights. As is so often the case, the author's note at the end added to my appreciation of the book. In it, Bossom shares the seed for the story, which was a young reader's request for a book on gay history, and how she wrestled with not knowing if she was the right person to write it. On the heels of the tragic shooting at Pulse, the gay nightclub in Orlando, where 49 people were killed and 53 others were wounded, Stonewall is a timely title that resonates for its respectful account of the ongoing struggle for gay rights. Teens who read Playing for the Devil's Fire by Philip Diedrich will witness a different kind of tragedy, which is the murder of innocent people by members of Mexican drug cartels. Though the events of this book are based on recent Mexican history, they're depicted here in a work of fiction. Main character Mosca is just an innocent boy who likes to play marbles with his friends in a village outside Mexico City. Then one day, they discovered the severed head of their teacher, propped on the ledge of a cement planter in the town plaza. In its mouth is a note that reads, "He talked too much." This gruesome act is just the beginning of a litany of violence in Moska's village. There will be more dead bodies and more severed body parts for Moska and his friends to discover. The grim horror of this is only countered by the boy's confusion. Who is doing these evil things, and why aren't the authorities trying to stop it? When Moska's parents fail to return from a trip to a nearby town, where they hope to enlist the aid of politicians and the federal police, Moska and his sister first imagine that they had car trouble. But as days go by, it's obvious that something more sinister has happened. Moska can't fathom it. "We were healthy, law-abiding people," he thinks to himself. "We believed in God. We went to Mass on Sundays." His parents never did anything to hurt anyone, so how could this happen? That is exactly the question that makes this book so powerful. Awful things happen in Moska's village and no one gets punished. This is reality. For many teen readers, the topic of Mexican drug cartels will be new, which makes this book all the more important to recommend. There are no happy endings here, but there is truth-telling. Teens deserve to hear that truth. The last set of books I want to tell you about are great coming-of-age stories by debut YA authors that expand the menu of diverse titles in YA Lit. Native Americans are one of the least represented groups in young adult literature. YA advocates who've read Sherman Alexie's absolutely true diary of a part-time Indian and want to read more books about life on the res may not know where to turn. That's why Eric Gansworth's middle grade novel, If I Ever Get Out of Here, is so important to share and promote. Here the setting is the Tuscarora Reservation in upstate New York, and the year is 1975. On the first page of the book, main character Lewis is having his best friend Carson cut off his braid. He hopes this will make it easier to fit in as he begins seventh grade. He's wrong, of course. Being Native will make him the target of personal attacks and the victim of institutional racism. But there's also a new kid, George, who lives on the nearby Air Force base. Like Lewis, George is smart and he loves Paul McCartney and Wings. Even though Lewis has every reason to be wary, he and George form a friendship. That friendship will be tested in countless ways, but readers will find hope in how it endures. There are a lot of different reasons why I love this book. The first is because it was honest. To Lewis, white people inhabit a foreign world. Hearing the way Lewis and his mom and his uncle talk about white people will be eye-opening for many teen readers. Here, whiteness is other, and that's vital for teens to see. So is the experience of living in extreme poverty. Part of Lewis's kitchen is uninhabitable because the roof is caved in. There's no running water or plumbing in his house. The matter-of-fact way Gansworth writes about these conditions invites neither pity nor sentimentality. It's just the reality of Lewis's life. Although it causes him shame, it's part of who he is. On the level of literary structure and style, I love seeing how Gansworth incorporated music by the Beatles and Wings throughout the novel. From chapter titles to scenes where Lewis and his uncle listen to the newest Wings album on a record player in the room they share. After I finished the book, I also loved reading the story of how Cheryl Klein, Gansworth's editor, acquired the manuscript. In a post to a children's literature listserv, Klein wrote that she wanted to publish more diverse titles, specifically books written by Native Americans. Children's literature critic and Native American activist Debbie Reese saw Klein's post and put her in touch with Gansworth. Backstories like this one serve as a crucial reminder. If we in the field want more diverse stories, then editors must be intentional about creating them, and readers must be intentional about advocating for them. You can read more about the backstory for Klein and Gansworth by clicking on the links in the show notes. Another book that gave me exposure to a world that was new to me is Bonnie Sue Hitchcock's The Smell of Other People's Houses. Here the setting is Alaska, and the narrative consists of four intertwining stories featuring four different characters. The bare bones version is this. Ruth will struggle with teenage pregnancy. Dora will try to survive child abuse. Alice will feel torn between her love of dance and life on her family's fishing boat. Hank and his brothers will run away from home. This kind of overview may cover the facts of the book, but it can never do justice to the elegance of the story and the writing. There's wonderful complexity here. You see it in the inner lives of the characters and the way their worlds intersect. You see it in Hitchcock's depiction of Alaska, a place that's both beautiful and wild, both gritty and urban. And you see it in the ways characters struggle to reconcile family history with the dreams they hold for their own lives. This is a book that's both quiet and lovely. Because YA publishers are generous, I'm lucky to have piles of advanced reading copies all through my house. Far too often, I pass over a good book just because it's competing for my attention with so many others. I'm so thankful that the publisher of this one decided to include a letter to readers from Hitchcock's editor, Wendy Lamb, on the second page of the ARC. Lamb has edited other authors I love, including Rebecca Stead, Dana Reinhart, Christopher Paul Curtis, and even Gary Paulsen. So when Wendy wrote in her letter that she acquired the smell of other people's houses after reading only five chapters, and that her interest in the book took shape because the writing was so vivid and the voice was so clear, and because when she looked away from the characters, the real world seemed dull, I knew I had to read it. I hope you will too. The last book I want to tell you about is a genre-blurring novel called Into White by Randy Pink. On the one hand, this is a work of contemporary realistic fiction about being a black girl in the wealthy white suburbs of Birmingham, Alabama. On the other hand, it's a work of magical realism. The school LaToya attends is mostly white. That means beauty standards are white, the latest fashions are white, and the power structure is white. One of the things I like best about this book is how blunt Randy Pink is in making these claims. LaToya looks at the clothes in her closet, the images presented on TV, and the style celebrated in magazines, and she thinks to herself, everything in the world was made for white girls. After a particularly frustrating and shameful moment at school, LaToya prays to Jesus. She tells him she can't take it anymore, and she begs him to change her. Anything but black, she pleads. The next thing she knows, her wish has been granted. To her family, she's still the same old Toya, but to the rest of the world, she's white. She returns to her school pretending to be an exchange student. Suddenly, she's blonde and popular. Not surprisingly, navigating this new white world is harder than Toya expects, and being separated from her old black life becomes increasingly uncomfortable. Like so many other YA novels, Into White explores the classic question of adolescence. Who am I and what am I going to do about it? But here the exploration is unapologetically race conscious. Some readers may take offense to this book, especially in passages where LaToya talks openly about the parts of black culture she hates. But what better way to open up conversations about racial identity development and the racialized experiences that all teens have in school? This conversation, too, deserves our advocacy. I want to end this show on a personal note. 8 years ago, when Kathy Fleischer, a professor at Eastern Michigan University and a board member for Read, Write, Think, asked me if I'd be interested in taking over hosting duties for this podcast, I didn't know what a podcast was. I said yes to the offer, because it sounded like interesting work, and because it would give me a chance to talk publicly about my love of young adult literature. Looking back, I never could have anticipated the doors that would open for me because of this role. I could never have imagined the books that would arrive in the mail, the interviews I would conduct with authors, or the connections I would make in the world of YA publishing. I also could not have predicted how this work would change me. It's great to love young adult literature, but only through hosting the podcast did I begin to learn how to channel that love on behalf of others.
Each month I faced the challenge of figuring out what I thought about the newest batch of books I'd read. Each month I enjoyed the privilege of talking about YA as a field of literature, and I did so with the backing of a national organization. I'll never be able to properly thank Lisa Fink and Scott Filkins for the support and creative freedom they have given me. Because of my work on the podcast, I've experienced greater richness in my own reading life, and I've learned to embrace the cause of YA advocacy. In light of that growth, this show feels like a fitting capstone. While I won't be doing any more podcasts for Read, Write, Think in the near future, I'll certainly continue to work in this field. I'll keep reading YA Lit, and I'll keep looking for ways to share great new titles with fellow YA readers. I know you will do the same. I hope you will read these books and recommend them to the teens in your life. Each title should be available at your local library or bookstore. Remember that no book is right for every reader, so preview books for appropriate reading level and content before passing them on to your teen. At some point in the future, I hope I'll be back to tell you about more great books for teens. Until then, I'm Jennifer Bueller. More episodes of Text Messages are available at www.readwritethink.org/textmessages. You can listen to our elementary book podcast, Chatting About Books, at www.readwritethink.org/chattingaboutbooks. Text Messages is supported by the Verizon Foundation through thinkfinity.org and produced monthly by the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. Music in this podcast is courtesy of Scott Andrew. Thanks for listening and look forward to more text messages soon.